21. Once his plan was laid, a plan that would rid him of both Roland and Peter forever, Flagg wasted no time. He first used all his wizardry to make the king well again. He was delighted to find that his magic potions worked better than they had for a long, long time. It was another irony. He earnestly wanted to make Roland better so the potions worked, but he wanted to make the king better so he could kill him and make sure everyone knew it was murder. It was really quite funny when you stop to think it over. On a windy night, less than a week after the king's hacking cough had ceased, Flagg unlocked his desk and took out the teak box. He murmured,
"Well done,"
to the Cleffa Carrot, which squeaked mindlessly in reply, and then lifted the heavy lid and took out the smaller box inside. He used the key around his neck to open it and took out the packet that contained the dragon sand. He had bewitched this packet, and it was immune to the dragon sand's terrible power. Or so he thought. Flagg took no chances and removed the packet with a small pair of silver tweezers. He laid it beside one of the king's goblets on his desk. Sweat stood out on his forehead in great round drops, for this was ticklish work indeed. One little mistake and he would pay for it with his life. Flagg went out into the corridor that led to the dungeons and began to pant. He was hyperventilating. When you breathe rapidly, you fill your whole body with oxygen and you can hold your breath for a long time. During the critical stage of his preparations, Flagg did not mean to breathe at all. But there would be no mistakes, big or little. He was having too much fun to die. He took a final great gasp of clean air from the barred window just outside the door to his apartment and re-entered his rooms. He went to the envelope, took his dagger from his belt, and delicately slit it open. There was a flat piece of obsidian, which the magician used as a paperweight on his desk. In those days, obsidian was the hardest rock known. Using the tweezers again, he grasped the packet, turned it upside down, and poured out most of the green sand. He saved back a tiny bit, hardly more than a dozen grains, but this bit of extra was extremely important to his plans. Hard as the obsidian was, the rock immediately began to smoke. 30 seconds had passed now. He picked up the obsidian, careful that not a single grain of dragon sand should touch his skin. If it did, it would work inward until it reached his heart and set it on fire. He tilted the stone over the goblet and poured it in. Now quickly, before the sand could begin to eat into the glass, he poured in some of the king's favorite wine, the same sort of wine Peter would be taking his father about now. The sand dissolved immediately. For a moment, the red wine glimmered a sinister green, and then it returned to its usual color. 50 seconds. Flagg went back to his desk. He picked up the flat rock and took his dagger by its handle. Only a few grains of dragon sand had touched the blade when he slit through the paper, but already they were working their way in, and evil little streamers of smoke rose from the pox in the Anduin steel. He carried both the stone and the dagger out into the hallway. 70 seconds, and his chest was beginning to cry for air. 30 feet down the hallway, which led to the dungeon if you followed it far enough, a trip no one in Delane wanted to make, there was a grating in the floor. Flagg could hear gurgling water, and if he had not been holding his breath, he would have smelled a foul stench. This was one of the castle's sewers. He dropped both the rock and the blade into it and grinned at the double splash in spite of his pounding chest. Then he hurried back to the window, leaned far out, and took breath after gasping breath. When he had his wind back, he returned to his study. Now only the tweezers, the packet, and the glass of wine stood on the desk. There was not so much as a grain of sand on the tweezers, and the bit of sand left inside the bewitched packet could not harm him as long as he took reasonable care. He felt he had done very well indeed so far. His work was by no means done, but it was well begun. He bent over the goblet and inhaled deeply. There was no danger now. When the sand was mixed with a liquid, its fumes became harmless and undetectable. Dragon sand made deadly vapors only when it touched a solid, such as stone, such as flesh. Flagg held the goblet up to the light, admiring its bloody glow.
"A final glass of wine, my king,"
he said, and laughed until the two-headed parrot screamed in fear.
"Something to warm your guts."
He sat down, turned over his hourglass, and began to read from a huge book of spells. Flagg had been reading from this book, which was bound in human skin, for 1,000 years and had gotten through only a quarter of it. To read too long of this book, written on the high, distant plains of Leng by a madman named Al-Hazred, was to risk madness. An hour. Just an hour. When the top half of his hourglass was empty, he could be sure Peter would have come and gone. An hour, and he could take Roland this final glass of wine. For a moment, Flagg looked at the bone-white sand slipping smoothly through the waist of the hourglass, and then he bent calmly over his book. 22. Roland was pleased and touched that Flagg should have brought him a glass of wine that night before he went to bed. He drank it off in 2 large gulps and declared that it had warmed him greatly. Smiling inside his hood, Flagg said,
I thought it would, Your Highness.
23. Whether it was fate or only luck that caused Thomas to see Flagg with his father that night is another question you must answer for yourself. I only know that he did see, and that it happened in large part because Flagg had been at pains over the years to make a special friend of this friendless, miserable boy. I'll explain in a moment, but first I must correct a wrong idea you may have about magic. In stories of wizardry, there are 3 kinds that are usually spoken of almost carelessly, as if any second-class wizard could do them. These are turning lead into gold, changing one's shape, and making oneself invisible. The first thing you should know is that real magic is never easy, and if you think it is, just try making your least favorite aunt disappear the next time she comes to spend a week or two. Real magic is hard. And although it is easier to do evil magic than good, even bad magic is tolerably hard. Turning lead into gold can be done, once you know the names to call on, and if you can find someone to show you exactly the right trick of splitting the loaves of lead. Shape-changing and invisibility, however, are impossible, or so close to it that you might as well use the word. From time to time, Flagg, who was a great eavesdropper, had listened to fools tell tales about young princes who escaped the clutches of evil genies by uttering a simple magic word and popping out of sight, or beautiful young princesses. In the stories, they were always beautiful, although Flagg's experience had been that most princesses were spoiled rotten and, as the end products of long inbred family lines, ugly as sin and stupid in the bargain, who tricked great ogres into becoming flies, which they then quickly swatted. In most stories, the princesses were also good at swatting flies, although most of the princesses Flagg had seen wouldn't have been able to swat a fly dying on a cold windowsill in December. In stories, it all sounded easy. In stories, people changed their shapes or turned themselves into walking window panes all the time. In truth, Flagg had never seen either trick done. He had once known a great Anduin magician who believed he had mastered the trick of changing his shape. But after 6 months of meditation and nearly a week of incantations and a series of agonizing body postures, he uttered the last awesome spell and succeeded only in making his nose nearly 9 feet long and driving himself insane. And there had been fingernails growing out of his nose, Flagg remembered with a grim little smile. Great magician or not, the man had been a fool. Invisibility was likewise impossible, at least as far as Flagg himself had been able to determine. Yet it was possible to make oneself dim. Yes, dim. That was really the best word for it, although others sometimes came to mind. Ghostly, transparent, unobtrusive. Invisibility was out of his reach, but by first eating a pizzle and then reciting a number of spells, it was possible to become dim. When one was dim, and a servant approached along a passageway, one simply drew aside and stood still and let the servant pass. In most cases, the servant's eyes would drop to his own feet or suddenly find something interesting to look at on the ceiling. If one passed through a room, conversation would falter and people would look momentarily distressed, as if all were having gas pains at the same time. Torches and wall sconces grew smoky. Candles sometimes blew out. It was necessary to actually hide when one was dim, only if one saw someone whom one knew well. For whether one was dim or not, these people almost always saw. Dimness was useful, but it was not invisibility. On the night Flag took the poisoned wine to Roland, he first made himself dim. He did not expect to see anyone he knew. It was after 9 o'clock now. The king was old and unwell, the days were short, and the castle went to bed early.
When Thomas is king,
Flag thought, carrying the wine swiftly through the corridors,
there will be parties every night.
He already has his father's taste for drink, although he favors wine rather than beer or mead. It should be easy enough to introduce him to a few stronger drinks. After all, am I not his friend?
Yes, when Peter is safely out of the way in the Needle and Thomas is king, there would be great parties every night.
Until the people in the alleys and the baronies are choked enough to rise in bloody revolt, then there will be one final party, the greatest of all. But I don't think Thomas will enjoy it. Like the wine I'm bringing his father tonight, that party will be extremely hot. He did not expect to see anyone he knew, and he didn't. Only a few servants passed him, and they drew away from the place where he stood almost absently, as if they felt a cold draft. All the same, someone saw him. Thomas saw him through the eyes of Niner, the dragon his father had killed long ago. Thomas was able to do this because Flag himself had taught him the trick. 24. The way his father had rejected the gift of the boat had hurt Thomas deeply, and after that he tended to keep clear of his father. All the same, Thomas loved Roland and badly wanted to make him happy the way Peter made him happy. Even more than that, he wanted to make his father love him the way he loved Peter. In fact, Thomas would have been happy if their father had loved him even half as much. The trouble was, Peter had all the good ideas first. Sometimes Peter tried to share his ideas with Thomas, but to Thomas the ideas either sounded silly, until they worked, or else he feared he wouldn't be able to do his share of the work, as when Peter had made their father a set of Bendo men 3 years ago. I'll give father something better than a bunch of stupid old game pieces, Thomas had said haughtily, but what he was really thinking was that if he couldn't make his father a simple wooden sailboat, he would never be able to help make something as difficult as the 20-man Bendo army. So Peter made the game pieces alone over a period of 4 months. The infantrymen, the knights, the archers, the fusilier, the general, the monk. And of course, Roland had loved them even though they were a bit clumsy. He had immediately put away the jade Bendo set the great Ellender had carved for him 40 years before and put the one Peter had made for him in its place. When Thomas saw this, he crept away to his apartments and went to bed, although it was the middle of the afternoon. He felt as if someone had reached into his chest and cut off a tiny piece of his heart and made him eat it. His heart tasted very bitter to him, and he hated Peter more than ever, although part of him still loved his handsome older brother and always would. And although the taste had been bitter, he had liked it, because it was his heart. Now there was the business of the nightly glass of wine. Peter had come to Thomas and said, I was thinking it would be nice if we brought Dad a glass of wine every night, Tom. I asked the steward, and he said he couldn't just give us a bottle because he has to make an accounting to the chief vintner at the end of each 6 month, but he said we could pool some of our money and buy a bottle of the Barony Fifth Vat, which is Father's favorite, and it's really not expensive. We'd have lots of our allowances left over, and I think that's the stupidest idea I ever heard, Thomas burst out. All the wine belongs to Father, all the wine in the kingdom, and he can have as much of it as he wants. Why should we spend our money to give Father something he owns anyway? We'll enrich that fat little steward, that's all we'll do. Peter said patiently, It will please him that we spent our money on him, even if it's something he owns anyway. How do you know that? Simply, maddeningly, Peter replied, I just do. Thomas looked at him, scowling. How could he tell Peter that the chief vintner had caught him in the wine cellar, stealing a bottle of wine just the month before? The fat little pig had given him a shaking and threatened to tell his father if Thomas didn't give him a gold piece. Thomas had paid, tears of rage and shame standing in his eyes. If it had been Peter, you would have turned the other way and pretended not to see, you slug. he thought. If it had been Peter, you would have turned your back, because Peter is going to be king someday soon, and I'll just be a prince forever. It also occurred to him that Peter never would have tried to steal wine in the first place, but the truth of this thought only made him angrier at his brother.
I just thought,
Peter began.
You just thought, you just thought,
Thomas mimicked savagely. Well, go think somewhere else. When Father finds out you paid the chief vintner for his own wine, he'll laugh at you and call you a fool. But Roland hadn't laughed at Peter, hadn't called him a fool. He had called him a good son in a voice that was unsteady and almost weepy. Thomas knew, because he had crept after when Peter took their father the wine that first night. He watched through the eyes of the dragon and saw it all. 25. If you had asked Flagg straight out why he had shown Thomas that place and the secret passageway which led to it, he would have been able to give you no very satisfactory answer. That was because he didn't exactly know why he had done it. He had an instinct for mischief in his head, just as some people have a way with numbers or a clear sense of direction. The castle was very old, and there were many secret doors and passages in it. Flagg knew most of them. No one, not even he, knew all of them, but this was the only one he had ever shown Thomas. His instinct for mischief told him that this one might cause trouble, and Flagg simply obeyed his instinct. Mischief, after all, was Flagg's cake and pie. Every now and then he would pop into Thomas's room and cry,
Tommy, you look glum. I've thought of something you might like to see. Want to go and have a look?
He almost always said, You look glum, Tommy, or You look a bit in the dumps, Tommy, or You look like you just sat on a pinch bug, Tommy, because he had a knack of showing up when Thomas was feeling particularly depressed or blue. Flagg knew that Thomas was afraid of him, and Thomas would find an excuse not to go with him unless he particularly needed a friend, and felt so low and unhappy he wouldn't be particular about which friend it was. Flagg knew this, but Thomas himself did not. His fear of Flagg ran deep. On the surface of his mind, he thought Flagg was a fine fellow, full of tricks and fun. Sometimes the fun was a bit mean, but that often suited Thomas's disposition. Do you think it strange that Flagg would know something about Thomas that Thomas didn't know about himself? It really isn't strange at all. People's minds, particularly the minds of children, are like wells, deep wells full of sweet water. And sometimes, when a particular thought is too unpleasant to bear, the person who has that thought will lock it into a heavy box and throw it into that well. He listens for the splash, and then the box is gone. Except it is not, of course. Not really. Flagg, being very old and very wise, as well as very wicked, knew that even the deepest well has a bottom, and just because the thing is out of sight doesn't mean it is gone. It is still there, resting at the bottom. And he knew that the caskets those evil, frightening ideas are buried in may rot, and the nastiness inside may leak out after a while and poison the water. And when the well of the mind is badly poisoned, we call the result insanity. If the magician showed him scary things in the castle sometimes, he did it because he knew that the more frightened of him Thomas was, the more power he would gain over Thomas, and he knew he could have that power because he knew something I've already told you, that Thomas was weak and often neglected by his father. Flagg wanted Thomas to be afraid of him, and he wanted to make sure that as the years passed, Thomas had to throw many of those locked boxes into the darkness inside him. If Thomas were to go insane at some point after he became king, well, what of that? It would make it easier for Flagg to rule. It would make his power all the greater. How did Flagg know the right times to visit Thomas and take him on these strange tours of the castle? Sometimes he saw what had happened to make Thomas sad or angry in his crystal. More often he simply felt an urge to go to Thomas and heeded it. That instinct for mischief rarely led him wrong. Once he took Thomas high into the eastern tower. They climbed stairs until Thomas was panting like a dog, but Flagg never seemed to lose his breath. At the top was a door so small that even Thomas had to crawl through it on his hands and knees. Beyond was a dark, rustling room with a single window. Flagg had led him to that window without a word, and when Thomas saw the view, the entire city of Delane, the near towns, and then the hills which stood between the near towns and the eastern barony marching off into a blue haze, He thought that the sight had been worth every stair his aching legs had climbed. His heart swelled with the beauty of it, and he turned to thank Flag. But something about the white blur of the magician's face inside his hood had frozen the words on his lips.
"Now watch this,"
Flag said, and held up his hand. A spurt of blue flame rose from his index finger, and the rustling sound in the room, which Thomas had first taken for the sound of the wind, turned to a rising whir of leathery wings. A moment later, Thomas was screaming and beating the air above his head as he blundered blindly back toward the tiny door. The little round room at the top of the castle's eastern tower had the best view in Delane's, save for the cell at the top of the needle. But now he understood why no one visited it. The room was infested with huge bats. Disturbed by the light Flag had raised, they whirled and swooped. Later, after they were out and Flag had quieted the boy, Thomas, who hated bats, had been in hysterics. The magician insisted it was just a joke meant to cheer him up. Thomas believed him, but for weeks after he awoke screaming with nightmares in which bats flapped around his head, got caught in his hair, and ripped at his face with their sharp claws and ratty teeth. On another excursion, Flag took him to the king's treasure room and showed him the mounds of gold coins, tall stacks of gold bars, and the deep bins marked emeralds, diamonds, rubies, fire dims, and so on. "Are they really full of jewels?" Thomas asked.
"Look and see,"
Flag said. He opened one of the bins and pulled out a handful of uncut emeralds. They sparkled wildly in his hand.
"My father's name!" Thomas gasped.
"Oh, that's nothing. Look over here. Pirate treasure, tell me."
He showed Thomas a pile of booty from the encounter with the Anduin pirates some 12 years ago. The Delane treasury was rich, the few treasure room clerks old, and this particular heap hadn't been sorted yet. Thomas gasped at heavy swords with jeweled hilts, daggers with blades that had been crusted with serrated diamonds so they would cut deeper,
heavy kill balls made of rhodochrosite.
"All this belongs to the kingdom?"
Thomas asked in an awed voice.
"It all belongs to your father,"
Flag replied, although Thomas had actually been correct.
"Someday it will all belong to Peter."
"And me," Thomas said with the 10-year-old's confidence.
"No,"
Flag said, just the right tinge of regret in his voice.
"Just to Peter, because he's the oldest, and he'll be king."
"He'll share," Thomas said, but with the slightest tremor of doubt in his voice. "Peter always shares."
"Peter's a fine boy, and I'm sure you're right. He'll probably share. But no one can make a king share, you know. No one can make a king do anything he doesn't want to do."
He looked at Thomas to gauge the effect of this remark, then looked back at the deep, shadowy treasure room. Somewhere, one of the aged clerks was droning out a count of ducats.
"Such a lot of treasure. And all for one man,"
Flag remarked.
"It's really something to think about, isn't it, Tommy?"
Thomas said nothing, but Flag had been well pleased. He saw that Tommy was thinking about it all right, and he judged that another of those poisoned caskets was tumbling down into the well of Thomas's mind. Kasplash! And that was indeed so. Later, when Peter proposed to Thomas that they share the expense of the nightly bottle of wine, Thomas had remembered the great treasure room, and he remembered that all the treasure in it would belong to his brother. "Easy for you to talk so blithely of buying wine. Why not? Someday you'll have all the money in the world." Then, about a year before he brought the poisoned wine to the king, on impulse, Flag had shown Thomas this secret passage, and on this one occasion his usually unerring instinct for mischief might have led him astray. Again, I leave it for you to decide. 26.
Tommy, you look down on the dumps,
he cried. The hood of his cloak was pushed back on that day, and he looked almost normal. Almost. Tommy felt down in them. He had suffered through a long luncheon at which his father had praised Peter's scores in geometry and navigation to his advisors with the most lavish superlatives. Roland had never rightly understood either. He knew that a triangle had three sides and a square had four. He knew you could find your way out of the woods when you were lost by following Old Star in the sky, and that was where his knowledge ended. That was where Thomas's knowledge ended, too, so he felt that luncheon would never be done. Worse, the meat was just the way his father liked it, bloody and barely cooked. Bloody meat made Thomas feel almost sick. My lunch didn't agree with me, that's all, he said to Flagg.
Well, I know just the thing to cheer you up,
Flagg said.
I'll show you a secret of the castle, Tommy, my boy.
Thomas was playing with a bugger lug bug. He had it on his desk and had set his schoolbooks around it in a series of barriers. If the trundling beetle looked as if he might find a way out, Thomas would shift one of the books to keep him in. I'm pretty tired, Thomas said. This was not a lie. Hearing Peter praised so highly always made him feel tired.
You'll like it,
Flagg said in a tone that was mostly wheedling, but a little threatening, too. Thomas looked at him apprehensively. There aren't any bats, are there? Flagg laughed cheerily, but that laugh raised goose flesh on Thomas's arms anyway. He clapped Thomas on the back.
Not a bat. Not a drip. Not a draft. Warm as toast. And you can peek at your father, Tommy.
Thomas knew that peeking was just another way of saying spying, and that spying was wrong, but this had been a shrewd shot all the same. This next time the buggerlug bug found a way to escape between two of the books, Thomas let it go. All right, he said, but there better not be any bats. Flagg slipped an arm around the boy's shoulders.
No bats, I swear. But here's something for you to mull over in your mind, Tommy. You'll not only see your father, you'll see him through the eyes of his greatest trophy.
Thomas's own eyes widened with interest. Flagg was satisfied. The fish was hooked and landed. What do you mean?
Come and see for yourself,
was all he would say. He led Thomas through a maze of corridors. You would have become lost very soon, and I probably would have gotten lost myself before long. But Thomas knew this way as well as you know your way through your own bedroom in the dark. At least, he did until Flagg led him aside. They had almost reached the king's own apartments when Flagg pushed open a recessed wooden door that Thomas had never really noticed before. Of course it had always been there, but in castles there are often doors, whole wings even, that have mastered the art of being dim. This passage was quite narrow. A chambermaid with an armload of sheets passed them. She was so terrified to have met the king's magician in this slim stone throat that it seemed she would happily have shrunk into the very pores of the stone blocks to avoid touching him. Thomas almost laughed because sometimes he felt a little like that himself when Flagg was around. They met no one else at all. Faintly, from below them, he could hear dogs barking, and that gave him a rough idea of where he was. The only dogs inside the castle proper were his father's hunting dogs, and they were probably barking because it was time for them to be fed. Most of Roland's dogs were now almost as old as he was, and because he knew how the cold ached in his own bones, Roland had commanded that a kennel be made for them right here in the castle. To reach the dogs from his father's main sitting chamber, one went down a flight of stairs, turned right, and walked 10 yards or so up an interior corridor. So Thomas knew they were about 30 feet to the right of his father's private rooms. Flagg stopped so suddenly that Thomas almost ran into him. The magician looked swiftly around to make sure they had the passageway to themselves. They did.
Fourth torn up from the one at the bottom with the chip in it.
Flag said.
Press it quick.
Ah, there was a secret here all right, and Thomas loved secrets. Brightening, he counted up 4 stones from the one with the chip and pressed. He expected some neat little bit of jiggery-pokery, a sliding panel perhaps, but he was quite unprepared for what did happen. The stones slid in with perfect ease to a depth of about 3 inches. There was a click. An entire section of wall suddenly swung inward, revealing a dark vertical crack. This wasn't the wall at all. It was a huge door. Thomas's jaw dropped. Flag slapped Thomas's bottom.
Quick, I said, you little fool.
He cried in a low voice. There was urgency in his voice, and this wasn't simply put on for Thomas's benefit, as many of Flag's emotions were. He looked right and left to verify that the passage was still empty.
Go now.
Thomas looked at the dark crack that had been revealed and thought uneasily about bats again. But one look at Flag's face showed him that this would be a bad time to attempt a discussion on the subject. He pushed the door open wider and stepped into the darkness. Flag followed at once. Thomas heard the low flap of the magician's cloak as he turned and shoved the wall closed again. The darkness was utter and complete, the air still and dry. Before he could open his mouth to say anything, the blue flame at the tip of Flag's index finger flared alight, throwing a harsh blue-white fan of illumination. Thomas cringed without even thinking about it, and his hands flew up. Flag laughed harshly.
No bats, Tommy. Didn't I promise?
Nor were there. The ceiling was quite low, and Thomas could see for himself. No bats, and warm as toast, just as the magician had promised. By the light of Flag's magic finger flare, he could also see they were in a secret passage which was about 25 feet long. Walls, floor, and ceiling were covered with ironwood boards. He couldn't see the far end very well, but it looked perfectly blank. He could still hear the muffled barking of the dogs.
When I said be quick, I meant it,
Flag said. He bent over Thomas, a vague, looming shadow that was, in this darkness, rather bat-like itself. Thomas drew back a step uneasily. As always, there was an unpleasant smell about the magician, a smell of secret powders and bitter herbs.
You know where the passage is now, and I'll not be the one to tell you not to use it. But if you're ever caught using it, you must say you discovered it by accident.
The shape loomed even closer, forcing Thomas back another step.
If you say I showed it to you, Tommy, I'll make you sorry.
I'll never tell, Thomas said. His words sounded thin and shaky.
Good. Better yet, if no one ever sees you using it. Spying on a king is serious business, prince or not. Now, follow me, and be quiet.
Flag led him to the end of the passageway. The far wall was also dressed with ironwood, but when Flag raised the flame that burned from the tip of his finger, Thomas saw 2 little panels. Flag pursed his lips and blew out the light. In utter blackness, he whispered,
Never open these 2 panels with a light burning. He might see. He's old, but he still sees well. He might see something, even though the eyeballs are of tinted glass.
What?
Shh! There isn't much wrong with his ears, either.
Thomas fell quiet, his heart pounding in his chest. He felt a great excitement that he didn't understand. Later he thought that he had been excited because he knew in some way what was going to happen. In the darkness he heard a faint sliding sound, and suddenly a dim ray of light, torchlight, lit the darkness. There was a second sliding sound, and a second ray of light appeared. Now he could see Flag again, very faintly, and his own hands when he held them up before him. Thomas saw Flag step up to the wall and bend a little. Then most of the light was cut out as he put his eyes to the 2 holes through which the rays of light fell. He looked for a moment, then grunted and stepped away. He motioned to Thomas.
Have a look,
he said. More excited than ever, Thomas cautiously put his eyes to the holes. He saw clearly enough, although everything had an odd greenish-yellow aspect. It was as if he were looking through smoked glass. A sense of perfect, delighted wonder rose in him. He was looking down into his father's sitting room. He saw his father slouched by the fire in his favorite chair, one with high wings which threw shadows across his lined face. It was very much the room of a huntsman. In our world, such a room would often be called a den, although this one was as big as some ordinary houses. Flaring torches lined the long walls. Heads were mounted everywhere, heads of bear, of deer, of elk, of wildebeest, of cormorant. There was even a grand feather ex, which is the cousin of our legendary bird, the phoenix. Thomas could not see the head of Niner, the dragon his father had killed before he was born, but this did not immediately register on him. His father was picking morosely at a sweet. A pot of tea steamed near at hand. That was all that was really happening in that great room that could have, and at times had, held upward of 200 people. Just his father with a fur robe draped around him having a solitary afternoon tea. Yet Thomas watched for a time that seemed endless. His fascination and his excitement with this view of his father cannot be told. His heartbeat, which had been rapid before, doubled. Blood sang and pounded in his head. His hands clenched into fists so tight that he would later discover bloody crescent moons imprinted into his palms where his fingernails had bitten. Why was he so excited simply to be looking at an old man picking half-heartedly at a piece of cake? Well, first you must remember that the old man wasn't just any old man, he was Thomas's father. And spying, sad to say, has its own attraction. When you can see people doing something and they don't see you, even the most trivial actions seem important. After a while, Thomas began to feel a little ashamed of what he was doing, and that was not really surprising. Spying on a person is a kind of stealing, after all. It's stealing a look at what people do when they think they are alone. But that is also one of its chief fascinations, and Thomas might have looked for hours if Flagg had not murmured,
"Do you know where you are, Tommy?"
I don't think so, he was going to add, but of course he did know. His sense of direction was good, and with a little thought he could imagine the reverse of this angle. He suddenly understood what Flagg meant when he said he, Thomas, would see his father through the eyes of Roland's greatest trophy. He was looking down at his father from a little more than halfway up the west wall, and that was where the greatest head of all was hung, that of Niner, his father's dragon. He might see something, even though the eyeballs are of tinted glass. Now he understood that, too. Thomas had to clap his hands to his mouth to stifle a shrill giggle. Flagg slid the little panels shut again, but he too was smiling.
No,
Thomas whispered.
No, I want to see more.
Not this afternoon,
Flagg said.
You've seen enough this afternoon. You can come again when you want. Although, if you come too often, you will surely be caught. Now come on, we're going back.
Flagg relit the magic flame and led Thomas down the corridor again. At the end, he put the light out and there was another sliding sound as he opened a peephole. He guided Thomas's hand to it so he would know where it was and then bade him look.
Notice that you can see the passageway in both directions,
Flagg said.
Always be careful to look before you open the secret door. Or someday you will be surprised.
Thomas put one eye to the peephole and saw, directly across the corridor, an ornate window with glass sides that angled slightly into the passageway. It was much too fancy for such a small passageway, but Thomas understood without having to be told that it had been put here by whoever had made the secret passageway. Looking into the angled sides, he could indeed see a ghostly reflection of the corridor in both directions.
Empty,
Flagg whispered.
Yes,
Thomas whispered back. Flagg pushed an interior spring, again guiding Thomas's hand to it for future reference, and the door clicked open.
Quickly now,
Flagg said. They were out and the door was shut behind them in a trice. 10 minutes later, they were back in Thomas's rooms.
Enough excitement for one day,
Flagg said.
Remember what I told you, Tommy. Don't use the passageway so often that you'll be caught. And if you are caught...
Flagg's eyes glittered grimly.
Remember that you found that place by accident.
I will,
Thomas said quickly. His voice was high and it squeaked like a hinge that needed oil. When Flagg looked at him that way, his heart felt like a bird caught in his chest, fluttering in panic. 27. Thomas heeded Flagg's advice not to go often, but he did use the passageway from time to time and peeked at his father through the glass eyes of Niner, peeked into a world where everything became greeny gold. Going away later with a pounding headache, as he almost always did, he would think, "Your head aches because you were seeing the way dragons must see the world, as if everything was dried out and ready to burn." And perhaps Flagg's instinct for mischief in this matter was not so bad at all, because by spying on his father, Thomas learned to feel a new thing for Roland. Before he knew about the secret passage, he had felt love for him, and often a sorrow that he could not please him better, and sometimes fear. Now he learned to feel contempt as well. Whenever Thomas spied into Roland's sitting room and found his father in company, he left again quickly. He only lingered when his father was alone. In the past, Roland rarely had been, even in such rooms as his den, which was a part of his private apartments. There was always one more urgent matter to be attended to, one more advisor to see, one more petition to hear. But Roland's time of power was passing. As his importance waned with his good health, he found himself remembering all the times he had cried to either Sasha or Flagg, "Won't these people ever leave me alone?" The memory brought a rueful smile to his lips. Now that they did, he missed them. Thomas felt contempt because people are rarely at their best when they are alone. They usually put their masks of politeness, good order, and good breeding aside. What's beneath? Some warty monster? Some disgusting thing that would make people run away screaming? Sometimes, perhaps, but usually it's nothing bad at all. Usually people would just laugh if they saw us with our masks off. Laugh, like a revolted face, or do both at the same time. Thomas saw that his father, whom he had always loved and feared, who had seemed to him the greatest man in the world, often picked his nose when he was alone. He would root around in first one nostril and then the other until he got a plump green booger. He would regard these with solemn satisfaction, turning each one this way and that in the firelight, the way a jeweler might turn a particularly fine emerald. Most of these he would then rub under the chair in which he was sitting. Others, I regret to say, he popped into his mouth and munched, with an expression of reflective enjoyment on his face. He would have only a single glass of wine at night, the glass which Peter brought him, but after Peter left he drank what seemed to Thomas huge amounts of beer. It was only years later that Thomas came to realize that his father hadn't wanted Peter to see him drunk, and when he needed to urinate he rarely used the commode in the corner. Most times he simply stood up and pissed into the fire, often farting as he did so. He talked to himself. He would sometimes walk around the long room like a man who was not sure where he was, speaking either to the air or to the mounted heads.
"I remember that day we got Shoebonzi,"
he would say to one of the elk heads. Another of his eccentricities was that he had named every one of the trophies.
"I was with Bill Squathings and that fellow with the great lump on the side of his face. I remember how you came through the trees and Bill let loose, and then that fellow with the lump let loose, then I let loose."
Then his father would demonstrate how he had let loose by raising his leg and farting, even as he mimed drawing back a bowstring and letting fly, and he would laugh an old man's shrill, unpleasant cackle. Thomas would slide the little panels back after a while and slink down the corridor again, his head pounding and an uneasy grin on his face, the head and grin of a boy who has been eating green apples and knows he may be sicker by morning than he is now. This was the father he had always loved and feared? He was an old man who farted out stinking clouds of steam. This was the king his loyal subjects called Roland the Good? He pissed into the fire, sending up more clouds of steam. This was the man who made his heart break by not liking his boat? He talked to the stuffed heads on his walls, calling them silly names like Bonesy and Stagpool and Puckerstring. He picked his nose and sometimes ate the boogers. I don't care for you anymore, Thomas would think, checking the peephole to make sure the corridor was empty and then creeping back to his room like a felon. You're a filthy, silly old man and you're nothing to me, nothing at all. No! But he was something to Thomas. Some part of him went on loving Roland just the same. Some part of him wanted to go to his father so his father would have something better to talk to than a bunch of stuffed heads on the walls. Still, there was that other part of him that liked spying better. 28. The night that Flagg came to King Roland's private rooms with the glass of poisoned wine was the first occasion in a very long time that Thomas had dared spy. There was a good reason for this. One night, about 3 months before, Thomas found himself unable to sleep. He tossed and turned until he heard the keep watchman cry 11. Then he got up, dressed, and left his rooms. Less than 10 minutes later, he was looking down into his father's den. He had thought his father might be asleep, but he was not. Roland was awake, and very, very drunk. Thomas had seen his father drunk many times before, but he had never seen him in anything remotely like his current state. The boy was flabbergasted and badly frightened. There are people much older than Thomas was then who harbor the idea that old age is always a gentle time, that an old person may exhibit gentle wisdom, gentle crabbiness or craftiness, perhaps the gentle confusion of senility. They will grant these, but find it hard to credit any real fire. They have an illusion that by the 70s any real fire must have faded to coals. That may be true, but on this night Thomas discovered that coals may sometimes flare up violently. His father was striding rapidly up and down the length of his sitting room, his fur robe flying out behind him. His nightcap had fallen off. His remaining hair hung down in tangled locks, mostly about his ears. He was not staggering, as he had done on other nights, moving tentatively with one hand out to keep from running into the furniture. He was rolling like a sailor, but he was not staggering. When he did happen to run into one of the high-backed chairs which stood near the walls beneath the snarling head of a lynx, Roland threw the chair aside with a roar that made Thomas cringe. The hairs on his arms prickled. The chair flew across the room and hit the far wall, its ironwood back splintered down the middle. In this bitter drunkenness, the old king had regained the strength of his middle years. He looked up at the lynx head with red, glaring eyes.
"Bite me!"
he roared at it. The raw hoarseness in his voice made Thomas cringe again.
"Bite me! Are you afeard? Come down out of that wall, Craker! Jump! Here's my chest, see?"
He tore open the robe, revealing his scrawny chest. He bared his few teeth at Craker's many and lifted his head.
"Here's my neck! Come on, jump! I'll do you with my bare hands! I'll rip your stinking guts out!"
He stood for a moment, chest out and head up, looking like an animal himself. An ancient stag, perhaps, that has been brought to bay and can now hope for nothing better than to die well. Then he whirled away, stopping at a bear's head to shake a fist at it and roar a string of curses at it, curses so terrible that Thomas, cringing in the dark, believed that the bear's outraged spirit might swoop down, reanimate the stuffed head, and tear his father open while he watched. But Roland was away again. He seized his mug, drained it, then whirled with brew dripping from his chops. He hurled the silver mug across the room, where it struck a stone angle of the fireplace hard enough to leave a dent in the metal. Now his father came down the room toward him, throwing another chair out of the way, then kicking a table aside with his bare foot. His eyes flicked up and met Thomas's own. Yes, they met his own eyes. Thomas felt their gazes lock, and a gray, swooning terror filled him like frozen breath. His father stalked toward him, his yellowed teeth bared, his remaining hair hanging over his ears, beard dripping from his chin and the corners of his mouth.
You.
Roland whispered in a low, terrible voice.
Why do you stare at me? What do you hope to see?
Thomas could not move. Found out, his mind gibbered. Found out by all the gods that ever were or shall be. I am found out, and I will surely be exiled. His father stood there, his eyes fixed on the mounted dragon's head. In his guilt, Thomas was sure his father had spoken to him, but this was not so. Roland had only spoken to Niner as he had spoken to the other heads. Yet if Thomas could see out of the tinted glass eyeballs, then his father could see in, at least to some degree. If Thomas hadn't been utterly paralyzed with fear, he would have run away in a panic. Even if he had summoned enough presence of mind to hold his ground, his eyes surely would have moved. And if Roland had seen the eyes of the dragon move, what might he have thought? That the dragon was coming to life again? Perhaps. In his drunken state, I even think that likely. If Thomas had so much as blinked his eyes on that occasion, Flagg would have needed no poison later. The king, old and frail in spite of the temporary potency the drink had given him, would almost surely have died of fright. Roland suddenly leaped forward.
Why do you stare at me?
He shrieked, and in his drunkenness it was Niner, Delane's last dragon, that he shrieked at, but of course Thomas did not know that.
Why do you stare at me so? I've done the best I could, always the best I could. Did I ask for this? Did I ask for it? Answer me, damn you. I did the best I could, and look at me now. Look at me now.
He pulled his robe wide open, showing his naked body, its gray skin blotchily flushed with drink.
Look at me now.
He shrieked again and looked down at himself, weeping. Thomas could take no more. He slammed shut the panels behind the dragon's glass eyes at the same moment his father took his eyes from Niner to look down at his own wasted body. Thomas crashed and blundered down the black corridor and slammed full force into the closed door, braining himself and falling in a heap. He was up in a moment, unaware of the blood pouring down his face from a cut in his forehead, pounding at the secret spring until the door popped open. He rushed out into the corridor, not even thinking to check if anyone was there to see him. All he could see was his father's glaring, bloodshot eyes. All he could hear was his father screaming, "Why do you stare at me?" He had no way of knowing that his father had already fallen into a sleep of deep drunkenness. When Roland woke up the next morning, he was still on the floor, and the first thing he did, in spite of his fiercely aching head and his throbbing, bruised body, Roland was far too old for such strenuous revels, was to look at the dragon's head. He rarely dreamed when he was drunk. There was only an interval of sodden darkness, but last night a terrible dream had come to him. The glass eyes of the dragon's head had moved and Niner came to life. The worm breathed its deadly breath down on him, and although he could not see that fire, he could feel it deep down inside him, hot and getting hotter. With this dream still lingering fresh in his mind, he dreaded what he might see when he looked up. But all was as it had been for years now. Niner snarled his fearsome snarl. His forked tongue lolled between teeth almost as long as fence pickets. His green-gold eyes stared blankly across the room. Ceremoniously crossed above this fabulous trophy were Roland's great bow and the arrow Foehammer, its tip and shaft still black with dragon blood. He mentioned this terrible dream once to Flagg, who only nodded and looked more thoughtful than usual. Then Roland simply forgot it. Forgetting was not so easy for Thomas. He was haunted for weeks by nightmares. In them, his father stared at him and shrieked,
"See what you've done to me!"
and threw his robe open to display his nakedness. Old, puckered scars, drooping belly, sagging muscles, as if to say this too had all been Thomas's fault, that if he hadn't spied. "Why do you never want to see Father anymore?" Peter asked him one day. "He thinks you're mad at him."
"That I'm mad at him?"
Thomas was astounded.
"That's what he said at tea today," Peter said.
He looked at his brother closely, observing the dark circles under Thomas's eyes, the pallor of Thomas's cheeks and forehead. Tom, what's wrong? Maybe nothing, Thomas said slowly. The next day he took tea with his father and brother. Going took all of his courage, but Thomas did have courage, and he sometimes found it, usually when his back was to the wall. His father gave him a kiss and asked him if anything was wrong. Thomas muttered that he hadn't been feeling well, but now he felt fine. His father nodded, gave him a rough hug, then went back to his usual behavior, which consisted mostly of ignoring Thomas in favor of Peter. For once, Thomas welcomed this. He didn't want his father looking at him any more than necessary, at least for a while. That night, lying awake for a long time in bed and listening to the wind moan outside, he came to the conclusion that he had had a very close shave, but that he had somehow gotten away with it. But never again, he thought. In the weeks after, the nightmares came less and less frequently. Finally, they stopped altogether. Still, the castle's head groom, Josef, was right about one thing. Boys are sometimes better at pledging vows than they are at keeping them, and Thomas's desire to spy on his father at last grew stronger than both his fears and his good intentions. And that is how it happened that on the night Flag came to Roland with the poisoned wine, Thomas was watching. 29. When Thomas got there and slid aside the two little panels, his father and his brother were just finishing their nightly glass of wine together. Peter was now almost 17, tall and handsome. The two of them sat by the fire, drinking and talking like old friends, and Thomas felt the old hate fill his heart with acid. After some little time, Peter arose and took courteous leave of his father.
"You leave earlier and earlier these nights," Roland remarked.
Peter made some demur. Roland smiled. It was a sweet, sad smile, mostly toothless.
"I hear," said he, "that she is lovely."
Peter looked flustered, which was uncommon with him. He stammered, which was even less common.
"Go," Roland interrupted. "Go. Be gentle with her and be kind, but be hot if there is ardor in you. Later years are cold years, Peter. Be hot while your years are green and fuel is plentiful and the fire may burn high."
Peter smiled. "You speak as if you were very old, father, but you still look strong and hale to me." Roland embraced Peter.
"I love you," he said.
Peter smiled with no awkwardness or embarrassment. "I love you too, Dad," he said, and in his lonely darkness, spying is always lonely work, and the spyer almost always does it in the dark, Thomas pulled a horrible face. Peter left, and for an hour or more not much happened. Roland sat morosely by the fire, drinking glass after glass of beer. He did not roar or bellow or talk to the heads on the walls. There was no destruction of furniture. Thomas had almost made up his mind to leave when there was a double rap at the door. Roland had been looking into the fire, almost hypnotized by the flicker play of the flames. Now he roused himself and called,
"Who comes?"
Thomas heard no response, but his father rose and went to the door as if he had. He opened it, and at first Thomas thought his father's habit of talking to the heads on the walls had taken a queer new turn, that his father was now inventing invisible human company to relieve his boredom.
"Strange to see you here at this hour," Roland said,
apparently walking back toward the fire in the company of no one at all.
"I thought you were always at your spells and conjurations after dark."
Thomas blinked, rubbed his eyes, and saw that someone was there after all. For a moment, he couldn't rightly make out who, and then he wondered how he could possibly have thought his father was alone when Flag was right there beside him. Flag was carrying two glasses of wine on a silver tray.
"Wives' tale, my lord. Magicians conjure early as well as late. But of course we have our darksome image to keep up."
Roland's sense of humor was always improved by beer, so much so that he would often laugh at things that weren't funny in the least. At this remark, he threw back his head and bellowed as if it was the greatest joke he had ever heard. Flag smiled thinly. When Roland's fit of laughing had passed, he said, "What's this, wine?"
"Your son is barely more than a boy, but his deference toward his father and his honor of his king have shamed me, a grown man."
Flag said,
"I brought you a glass of wine, my king, to show you that I too love you."
He passed it to Roland, who looked absurdly touched. "Don't drink it, father," Thomas thought suddenly. His mind was full of an alarm he couldn't understand. Roland's head came up suddenly and tilted, almost as if he had heard.
"He's a good boy, my Peter," Roland said.
"Indeed,"
Flag replied.
"Everyone in the kingdom says so."
"Do they?" Roland asked, looking pleased. "Do they indeed?"
"Yes, so they do. Shall we toast him?"
Flag raised his glass.
"No, father!"
Thomas shouted in his mind again. But if his father had heard his first thought, he didn't hear this one. His face shone with love for Thomas's elder brother.
"To Peter, then."
Roland raised the glass of poisoned wine high.
"To Peter."
Flag agreed, smiling.
"To the king."
Thomas cringed in the dark. "Flag's making two different toasts. I don't know what he means, but father." This time, it was Flag who turned his darkly considering gaze toward the dragon's head for a moment, as if he had heard the thought. Thomas froze, and in a moment Flag's gaze turned back to Roland. They clinked glasses and drank. As his father quaffed the glass of wine, Thomas felt a splinter of ice push its way into his heart. Flag made a half turn in his chair and threw his glass into the fire.
"Peter."
"Peter,"
Roland echoed and threw his own. It smashed against the sooty brickwork at the back of the fireplace and fell into the flames, which for a moment seemed to flare an ugly green. Roland raised the back of his hand to his mouth for a moment as if to stifle a belch.
"Did you spice it?"
he asked.
"It tasted almost mulled."
"No, my lord,"
Flag said gravely, but Thomas thought he sensed a smile behind the mask of the magician's gravity, and that splinter of ice slipped further into his heart. Suddenly he wanted no more of spying, not ever. He closed the peepholes and crept back to his room. He felt first hot, then cold, then hot again. By morning he had a fever. Before he was well again, his father was dead. His brother imprisoned in the room at the top of the needle, and he was a boy king at the age of barely 12. Thomas the Lightbringer, he was dubbed at the coronation ceremonies. And who was his closest advisor? You guess. 30. When Flag left Roland, the old man was feeling sprightlier than ever by then, a sure sign the dragon sand was at work in him. He went back to his dark basement rooms. He got out the tweezers and the packet containing the remaining few grains of sand and put them on his huge old desk. Then he turned his hourglass over and resumed reading. Outside, the wind screamed and gobbled. Old wives cringed in their beds and slept poorly and told their husbands that Rhiannon, the dark witch of the coos, was riding her hateful broom this night, and wicked work was afoot. The husbands grunted, turned over, told their wives to go back to sleep and leave them alone. They were dull fellows for the most part. When an eye is wanted to see straws flying in the wind, give me an old wife any day. Once a spider skittered halfway across Flag's book, touched a spell so terrible not even the magician dared use it, and turned instantly to stone. Flag grinned. When the hourglass was empty, he turned it over again. And again. And again. He turned it over 8 times in all, and when the 8th hour's worth of sand was nearly gone, he set about finishing his work. He kept a large number of animals in a dim room down the hall from his study, and he went there first. The little creatures skittered and cringed when Flag came near. He did not blame them. In the far corner was a wicker cage containing 6 brown mice. Such mice were everywhere in the castle, and that was important.
Down here there were also huge rats, but it was not a rat Flag wanted tonight. The royal rat upstairs had been poisoned. A simple mouse would be enough to make sure the crime came home to the royal ratling. If all went well, Peter would soon be as tightly locked up as these mice. Flag reached into the cage and removed one. It trembled wildly in his cupped hand. He could feel the rapid thrumming of its heart, and he knew that if he simply held it, it would soon die of fright. Flag pointed the little finger of his left hand at the mouse. The fingernail glowed faintly blue for a moment.
"Sleep,"
the magician commanded, and the mouse fell on its side and went to sleep on his open palm. Flag took it back into his study and laid it on his desk, where the obsidian paperweight had rested earlier. Now he went into his larder and drew a little mead from an oaken barrel into a saucer. He sweetened it with honey. He put it on his desk, then went out into the corridor and breathed deeply at the window again. Holding his breath, he came back in and used the tweezers to pour all but the last 3 or 4 grains of dragon sand into the honey-sweetened mead. Then he opened another drawer of his desk and removed a fresh packet, which was empty. Then, reaching all the way to the back of this drawer, he brought out a very special box. The fresh packet was bewitched, but its magic was not very strong. It would hold the dragon sand safely only for a short while. Then it would begin to work on the paper. It would not set it alight. Not inside the box. There would not be air enough for that. But it would smoke and smolder, and that would be enough. That would be fine. Flag's chest was thudding for air, but he still spared a moment to look at this box and congratulate himself. He had stolen it 10 years ago. If you had asked him at the time why he took it, he would have known no more than he knew why he had shown Thomas the secret passage that ended behind the dragon's head. That instinct for mischief had told him to take it, and that he would find a use for it, so he had. After all those years in his desk, that useful time had come. Peter was engraved across the top of the box. Sasha had given it to her boy. He had left it for a moment on a table in a hallway when he had to run down the hallway after something or other. Flag came along, saw it, and popped it into his pocket. Peter had been grief-stricken, of course, and when a prince is upset, even a prince who was only 6 years old, people take notice. There had been a search, but the box had never been found. Using the tweezers, Flag carefully poured the last few grains of dragon sand from the original packet, which had been wholly enchanted, into the packet which had been only incompletely enchanted. Then he went back to the window in the corridor to draw fresh breath. He did not breathe again until the fresh packet had been laid in the antique wooden box, the tweezers laid in there beside it, the top of the box slowly closed, and the original packet disposed of in the sewer. Flag was hurrying now, but he felt secure enough. Mouse, sleeping. Box, closed. Incriminating evidence safely latched inside. It was very well. Pointing his little finger of his left hand at the mouse lying stretched out on his desk like a fur rug for pixies, Flag commanded,
"Wake."
The mouse's feet twitched. Its eyes opened. Its head came up. Smiling, Flag wiggled his little finger in a circle and said,
"Run."
The mouse ran in circles. Flag wiggled his finger up and down.
"Jump."
The mouse began to jump on its hind legs like a dog in a carnival, its eyes rolling wildly.
"Now drink,"
Flag said, and pointed his little finger at the dish holding the honey-sweetened mead. Outside, the wind gusted to a roar. On the far side of the city, a bitch gave birth to a litter of 2-headed pups. The mouse drank.
"Now,"
said Flag, when the mouse had drunk enough of the poison to serve his purpose,
"sleep again."
And the mouse did. Flag hurried to Peter's rooms. The box was in one of his many pockets. Magicians have many, many pockets. And the sleeping mouse was in another. He passed several servants and a laughing gaggle of drunken courtiers, but none saw him. He was still dim. Peter's rooms were locked, but that was no problem for one of Flag's talents. 3 passes with his hands and the door was open. The young prince's rooms were empty, of course. The boy was still with his lady friend. Flag didn't know as much about Peter as he did about Thomas, but he knew enough.
He knew, for instance, where Peter kept the few treasures he thought worth hiding away. Flagg went directly to the bookcase and pulled out three or four boring textbooks. He pushed at a wooden edging and heard a spring click back. He then slid a panel aside, revealing a recess in the back of the case. It was not even locked. In the recess was a silk hair ribbon his lady had given him, a packet of letters she had written him, a few letters from him to her, which burned so brightly he did not dare to send them, and a little locket with his mother's picture inside it. Flagg opened the engraved box and very carefully shredded one corner of the packet's flap. Now it looked as if a mouse had been chewing at it. Flagg closed the lid again and put the box in the recessed space.
You cried so when you lost this box, dear Peter,
he murmured.
I think you may cry even more when it's found.
He giggled. He put the sleeping mouse beside the box, closed the compartment, and put the books neatly back in place. Then he left and slept well. Great mischief was afoot, and he felt confident that he had moved as he liked to move, behind the scenes, seen by no one.